All right. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Jake Dunlap Show. We are very excited that you joined us. If you haven't tuned in, this is the show where we talk to celebrities, thought, and industry leaders to really discover their journey to success. I am super excited that you're joining us. This show is like no other. I can promise you that. You might laugh, you might cry, but you will definitely leave inspired and gain a whole new level of insight into those people that you follow, love, and admire. All right, welcome everyone to another episode of The Jake Dunlap Show. I am super excited for today's guest. This gentleman isn't just a battle-hardened special forces soldier. He's also passionate about empowering his fellow veterans after their life in the military. He served in Korea and led his troops with great distinction in Iraq and many other places all over the globe. He's won 3 Bronze Stars. After a decades-long career in the military, he founded his organization, which works with Medal of Honor awardees, U.S. Rangers, Navy SEALs, and many other veterans and their families to help them find purpose again. So I want you to please join me in welcoming Green Beret, best-selling author, founder of Warrior Rising and Mission 60, and an all-around good dude, Jason Van Camp. Jason, thank you so much for joining me.
Jake, thanks for having me. The last line that you said, all-around good dude, that was my favorite line. So that's all I want to be known for.
That's kind of it, right? We get so focused on, you know, how much money your bank account has, or, you know, your flex or what you look like. And the reality is, that's kind of the goal, right? You know?
Oh, yeah.
Known as a good dude. So we talked about this a little bit. You know, what we focus on here in the show is really helping to tell the story of how people, you know, arrived at the points that we all know them now. I'm really excited to help tell, you know, kind of walk through your story. Pretty awesome. Like, you know, there's just a lot going on. So I think it's going to be great for our listeners, you know, again, who really enjoy hearing those paths to success and definitely can relate. So we're going to go back in time. So we're going to go back to D.C. So born in Washington, D.C., but then moved to Springfield, Virginia. How old were we when you moved? When you moved originally?
Oh, the thing was, my parents had just bought a house in Springfield this new, you know, neighborhood, new location, right on the edge of the woods and a lake. But my mother was working in Washington, D.C. at the time. And so she was working, I guess, when she was like 9 months pregnant. And she went into labor and they took her to George Washington University Hospital, which since has been demolished and then rebuilt. But that's where I was born, man, at George Washington and in Washington, D.C., man. So I've always considered myself a son of Washington, which I've been proud of.
There you go. So what was life? So again, you mentioned lake, forest, et cetera. So what was life like growing up in Springfield? You know, I know, you know, what were those kind of early years like for you?
You know, we lived in a neighborhood with a lot of kids. And so it was sort of that 80s iconic kids riding their bikes all up and down the street. You know, doors weren't locked. The parents weren't worried about, you know, pedophiles or predators or anything like that, which they probably should have been worried about at the time, because now with this, all this information coming out, like I've got 2 small kids. I'm terrified to let them out of my sight, even in the backyard. You know what I mean? And so we lived in a time when kids, we would ride our bikes up the street, play, you know, catch the flag till, you know, till it was dark outside, ran home and had dinner. And then there was a lake literally across the street. We'd go there and go fishing all the time, or, you know, just get muddy and just play war games. And, you know, it was just awesome.
Were there a lot of other, like, were there a lot of military families or other families there as well too?
That's what you find in the Washington, D.C. area, in the DMV, you know, especially in Northern Virginia. My dad was in the Army. He was in the Signal Corps during Vietnam. He got out and became a civilian, right? So he still worked as a contractor for the he worked at the Pentagon. And I asked him when I was young, like, what do you do? You know, and it was something we had to figure out for a school project when I was in first grade or something. And my dad was like, I work for the government. And I was like, well, what do you do in the government? He says, I work with computers. And I said, well, what do you do with the computers? And he said, that's all I'm going to tell you. And I was kind of like, well, what am I going to say? I go to school. My dad's going to sound like the most boring guy ever. And so you go to school and we had like this presentation. I was like, my dad works for the government. And all the other kids, like half the kids in the class were like, yeah, my dad works for the government. And that was it. That was it. They couldn't talk about it, you know? It was either that or they had their dads in the military. Some of them had their moms in the military as well. And so you grew up around that, and you grew up around the idea of knowing about being patriotic, about serving your country, you know, and a lot of kids, when they're around parents like that, they think, oh, I'm going to grow up and do the exact same thing. I didn't necessarily think, oh, I'm going to be in the military when I grew up, but I had a deep appreciation for the military. I was deeply patriotic. And it was one of two things that you learned growing up in the 80s in Washington, D.C., in that area. It's one, you know, we hate the Russians. And number two, we hate the Dallas Cowboys. You know, yeah, and that was kind of it, man.
Understood. Yeah, and it's going to be interesting. We'll fast forward to then you end up going to Russia too, which I think is
exactly
also fascinating, right? It's kind of funny how that works. So, I mean, what are some things that stand out? I mean, it sounds like it was, you know, again, it's like this group of people or their parents are, you know, they kind of, then it might probably don't work together, but they all kind of have the similar types of experience. You know, there's some memories that stand out about whether it's, you know, working, you know, interactions with your parents or, you know, some lessons from that time that you kind of look back about. Again, like you said, it's probably a lot of those kids you're playing with, they end up going to the military or some other form of service. You know, some things that you remember from that early adolescence, you know, before you get into high school that, you know, you kind of have referenced back over the years of, you know, whether it's experiences with friends or family that helped to kind of shape some of the things that you're doing now.
A lot of it had to do with playing sports. You know, it was an area where there was a lot of competitive sports, and my parents wanted me to play as many sports as I possibly could. You know, I started out playing soccer. I was in ballet for a few seasons.
We got to find videos of that, man.
Yeah,
are there videos or pictures that exist of this?
It was funny because my dad read an article about some of the Washington Redskins players doing ballet for balance and things like that. So he wanted me to do it. But then I was also in taekwondo and basketball and lacrosse and track and field. And for a time I was in baseball. I love baseball, but I was the worst baseball player ever, man. I couldn't hit anything.
That's how I was. I was very similar.
I took a lot of walks, you know, either I walked or I swung and missed. I always went for the home run, man. I never hit that damn ball. But I love baseball. I'm a huge Nats fan, and my cousin actually was really good at baseball. He's pitching in the majors right now for the Dodgers. Wow. Yeah, so I'm not sure if it ran the family or anything like that, but it was just something that I need to do a lot more work on.
Yeah, I wonder if what was I going to say? I wonder if they did the Dodgers win today? Weren't they playing in the wild card today?
I think they played tonight. They play St. Louis.
It's tonight. Yeah, you're tonight. So all of you in the future already know what's happened. Yeah, for me in baseball when I was a kid, I was small when I was like early, like growing up until high school. And like there's one game I got hit three times. And that's how I got on base. I'd be like, ugh. And then I'd take the hit. I could play the field, but like, yeah, I was not very good. So I can relate. So you're playing a lot of sports. You've got this kind of like tight, very, sounds like very tight knit group. And then you go to West Springfield High, 95 to 2001. Does that sound right?
No, 91 to 95. So I graduated
91 high school to 95. 95. Yeah. I had the one in the wrong place. So 91 to 95. So what was high school like? So this is like early 90s. You're in high school in Virginia, like maybe now kind of like end of the mullet. You probably don't. I don't think there's like that starting to like go out of maybe a little bit, maybe still a little bit. There's a lot of that going on.
I think I overstayed the mullet welcome, meaning I had the mullet for a little bit longer than it was in style. So I definitely had a mullet my freshman year, and the Redskins, the Washington football team, won the Super Bowl. So that was a big thing for my community. And then my sophomore year, there was an opportunity for some sophomores to make the varsity football team. And it was kind of a big deal to make the varsity squad as a sophomore. And I made it along with, I think, one other guy. And I actually started that year as a sophomore at linebacker, which is a big deal. And as part of the initiation process in high school, they shaved my head, you know, so they shaved my mullet off. So I had a shaved head when I was a sophomore for the football season.
No, man.
That was the last of the mullet. It never grew back.
You didn't even bring it back? There was never a time?
Never brought it back.
No.
Never. I sort of had that mohawk. You know that mohawk?
Yeah, like a Brian Bosworth type thing.
No, more like lately. It's sort of like short on the sides and long, and it kind of comes down the back. Yeah.
Oh, it's coming back.
I had that a little bit a couple of years ago.
Oh, that's all right.
I didn't mind it.
That was the look, man.
My wife didn't like it so much, though. So
she finally made you get rid of it. That's kind of how it works.
Yeah.
So all right. So high school, playing lots of sports. Football, obviously, is where you're excelling. You know, again, it's kind of similar question. What are some things in high school? You know, you obviously would go on to play football at, you know, West Point too. You know, what are some, you know, key memories you have there? You know, what are some things that stand out for you around, you know, again, experiences or maybe things that happened with your family, you know, from that era?
You know, my family, I love them so much. Love them, you know, to the ends of the earth. We experienced a lot of health issues in my family. When I was a freshman in high school, I was working out a lot. I was going to the gym a lot. And it was crazy because apparently my muscles were growing faster than my bones, my body. And the reason I say this is because during the last week of school in preparation for football the next year, we did running and sprints, and the coaches would take your time and everything. And I was running a 40-yard dash, and I felt something pop in my hip, and I fell to the ground, and my muscle had pulled out part of my hip. And so my hip had cracked, and it was kind of in, you know, the bone was in my thigh. And so all during that summer, I just laid in bed the entire summer. And my father, leading up to high school, you know, he had a very severe heart attack. He had a brain aneurysm. Mother had terminal lung cancer. And so that was a situation where, you know, we had to appreciate every day, every moment together, you know, and be there for each other and help each other out. And so my parents, a lot of kids think, oh, I'm embarrassed because my parents, they don't want to drive me to the mall or whatever. And, you know, I always thought my parents were pretty cool. You know, I always admired them because they overcame a lot of adversity, and they never complained about it, you know, and they put all of their effort and their time into their kids, into making sure that they were happy. They got everything that they needed. They were supported. And then above all else, that they knew they were loved. And so those are lessons that have been instilled in me and that I want to, you know, take with me as a father for my kids too, you know, and I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, man. Well, that's awesome. I mean, that you got a chance to, you know, experience that, and you had that, you know, I guess not a lot. Sometimes in high school, right, or in military families, it's a little different, right? Sometimes it's a little colder at times or a different experience. So, you know, it's amazing that you got to experience that. And then, you know, I know that then you went on to West Point. Did your mother pass away at some point around then, or was that later?
Yeah, I went to my freshman year at West Point, and then I knew I was going to serve a mission for my church. You know, when you grow up in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints community, it's kind of ingrained in you that you should go on a mission, you know, a 2-year mission. And then you get excited about it because you could get called anywhere. And from a young age, I made the decision and I knew I was going on a mission. And so when I was recruited by Army, by West Point, I told them, I said, hey, at some point I want to serve a mission. And they said, okay, that's no problem. We've actually had a couple people serve missions before. And so I went a year, freshman year at West Point. I played in some of the games as a true freshman. I just wasn't physically ready for that. I played some special teams.
I bet.
You know, man, it's just like, for me.
What was that leap like? I mean, I know we're going to get into some more, you know, some deeper, but what was that leap like for you? It's funny. I had Dave Meltzer on the podcast a few weeks ago. And he also played football. And he said his very first play running on special teams, he got ran over by Christian Okoye, of all people.
Oh my
And gosh. That's when he realized he was not playing in the NFL. He's like, if this guy's playing D3 football, he's like, I can't imagine what it's going to be like at that level. So do you remember what it was like your first game, or when you realize, like, oh man, I'm not at this level?
When the Nigerian nightmare runs you over, you know you're right. Not playing in the NFL.
That's right.
My experience was weird because I was kind of like, I felt like I was the golden boy, the heavily recruited athlete at West Point. And so I was pushed really hard as a true freshman, and given a lot of opportunities that others weren't. You know, I was like number two on the depth chart coming right into, you know, the first training camp. And I wanted to feel like I earned this. I worked hard to get it. And I was never in a position before in my life where somebody just gave me something like that. And it was weird and it was uncomfortable. And I didn't like it. And then on top of that, you know, we had just gone through Beast Barracks, where it was straight military, out in the field, living in the woods, like running around every morning, you know, doing the military thing, to, okay, now you're in football two-a-days immediately. And I remember weighing in the first day, and I was close to 200 pounds in high school linebacker, which is a very undersized linebacker, which is why I got recruited by West Point. And I remember weighing in the first day of football, and I was 178 pounds. And I was like, oh my God, I'm going to be a linebacker playing at 178. You know, like eventually I'll get my weight back up. I'll get strong again. I'll feel good again. The coaches didn't have time for that, man. They put me in right away. And I was just getting my ass kicked, man. I mean, it was like
right.
Spinning around. They're trying to learn the defense. I didn't even know the defense. I was asking questions. I was, you know, when you don't know what you're doing, you know, you're in a tough spot, man. You just kind of hope and pray. And so I was just trying to get lined up right, let alone like make the tackle, you know?
Right.
And so the first game of the season I played, and I didn't play bad at all. Like, and I almost had a sack, almost had a pick, had a pass breakup, had a couple tackles. And that was pretty cool. It was a pretty cool experience. We weren't playing a powerhouse or anything. We were playing Lehigh University. We won like 42-10. And it was a cool experience, man, that first game. And then after my sophomore year, our sophomore season as a football team, we were pretty good. We were 10-2. We went to a bowl game. And then after that, I left to go on a mission to Russia. And so I went to Russia, St. Petersburg, Russia, in that area.
How'd you pick that? Like, how did you pick Russia out of, like, because I know part of it is, you know, you get at least a input there. But why Russia?
It's a luck of the draw, man. I had absolutely zero input whatsoever. You know, you submit your packet to our church, and then a few months later, they send you a letter in the mail, and it says, congratulations, you have been called to serve in the X mission. And mine said, St. Petersburg, Russia mission. And my parents actually opened it and read it to me over the phone. I didn't get a chance to read it myself. And I was excited to go. You know, I was excited to leave West Point more than anything. I wanted to get the hell out of there.
Man, I mean, what was that like, man? 2 years, young guy. I mean, again, we're like, you know, the Cold War ended, you know, 7-8 years before that, but still, you know, tensions aren't great. Like, what was that experience like? You know, what are some things, again, you know, here's a guy, you know, again, you've kind of grown up in this area, you know, a lot of your life. You know, did your family travel a lot? Did you do a lot of vacations, or is this like a first real, like, out in the wild?
My mother worked for Delta Airlines. So we traveled flight passes around the country, but the only time I ever went outside the country was to the Bahamas when I was 12 years old.
Yeah.
So this was really the first time I ever went to a foreign country. And I remember landing and we were all exhausted. It's a long flight, you know. And it was, I got there in March and it was cold, you know, and I just remember thinking, man, it's this place is dirty, you know, and we're kind of driving down the streets and we see all these beautiful buildings. And I remember our driver was like, that's the Church of Atheism. And I remember thinking, man, they have a Church of Atheism here. That's insane. And pretty soon I learned to love the country and the people. I have a really hard time, as does 99% of the people, speaking the language. And so it took me a good year before I had a foundation. And then after that foundation was set, I took off and I got better every single week. I doubled my speaking ability, you know, every single week. And by the end of my mission, I was pretty fluent, and I was pretty proud of that because it takes a lot of hard work. You got to get up early and study. You got to check your ego at the door and be okay with making mistakes and getting corrected and just bouncing back up. So it was super interesting. And especially when you read something in a foreign language, you can see how there's different perspectives on life and how people see things differently than you do.
Interesting.
And just really opened my mind. And I had an amazing time there.
And what, I mean, because it's just you and like how many guys are there with you? You know, how many people are you teamed up with?
Well, you know, you team up with at least one person at a time, sometimes two people. So sometimes you're in a three partnership. Most of the time it's just you and another guy. And there's a lot of responsibility on your shoulders, man. You're a 19-year-old kid. You got to find a place to live. You got to pay rent. You got to pay utilities, you know, and then you're outside the door, you know, at 8 o'clock every morning out there talking to strangers about religion in Russia, communist Russia, where they don't, you know, they're basically atheists under communism. And so you get used to a lot of rejection. You get used to understanding how to sell something effectively, sell yourself, be personable, have emotional intelligence. All that stuff is, and you learn it at such a young age, you know, and it's just, it's so impactful. Which is why you see a lot of Mormons, you know, in the future doing pretty well with presenting or communicating or selling, you know, in business because they've learned it.
One of my top guys in Phoenix ended up coming out to San Francisco with me. He was Mormon as well, too. And there's also a work ethic, too, right? Like, you know, this is what you're going to go do. I mean, being in Russia, then any like harrowing experiences? Are there any experiences that stand out to you as like,
oh, yeah. Every day was a harrowing experience, man. Like, you get chased by people every now and again. Like, you get door slammed in your face. You get into somebody's apartment where it's like, man, this is, we got to get out of here. Two stories I'll tell you. One is I was arrested by the cops twice and, not for doing anything wrong, just for being an American, you know, and trying to talk to a cop. And that was always pretty interesting. They put you in a jail cell and then they'll, you know, you give them your contact information. We have a lawyer that's on retainer. At least we did at the time. And they would call the lawyer and eventually the lawyer would get you released. So right. That was interesting. And then when I was responsible for an entire city up north called Petrozavodsk. And it was a smallish town. And there were only six missionaries up there and I was in charge. And it was when I was a little bit older as a missionary, you know, and it was an amazing experience. And one day this like sedan shows up outside my house, my apartment, right? And they're waiting for me, you know, and we walk out and they're like, get in. And my companion, my partner, he didn't speak Russian very well at all. So he had no idea what was going on.
Oh, no.
You know, and so I'm like, I'm on my own here, man. Like so I'm like, I could run away. I could yell. I could scream or I could be just confident. And so I just like own the room, man, own the area. I was confident. I'm like, open the door. And they opened the door. I got in like I owned the place and they drove away with me. And it was a mafia sort of situation. And they take me to this boat on the lake, you know, and they're like, you know, they're thinking maybe they got to grab me or handcuff me or push me on. I'm like telling them to go. And so I'm like, let's go. I need to talk to your boss. And so like we go and I sit down with the boss and he's like, you're not going anywhere. I'm like, listen, what can your organization do for me? You know, like my organization, like I started telling him about my organization, his organization, how we can help each other out. And so instead of him like trying to kidnap me for ransom or something like that, it turned out to be like, okay, we'll give you this, you give us this, and we'll make a deal. Now we're buddies. And so I'm negotiating with this guy in real time. And at the end of the conversation, we're like best buds. Like we give each other a hug and I leave. And like my companion, he's just sitting there like, is it my turn to give the discussion? Like, should I bear my testimony right now? It's like, no, man, this isn't one of those meetings.
You got to save that.
We're good, man. We're good. And so I don't think still to this day he knew what was going on. And so these mafia guys, like, they gave me protection. We gave them a bunch of printers and a bunch of stuff. And like, it was just a great deal that you know, it's just all because you kept your cool, kept my head. I turned this disadvantage into an advantage, to an opportunity. And it was
where'd that come from? You know, where, when you kind of look back, I mean, you're 20 basically at this time, like, where did that come from? You know, the ability to kind of be present, not, you know, your partner's like, okay, is this where we talk? You know, like, where do you think that came from?
You know, it's got to come from your upbringing, your foundation, you know, your parents, you know, and that's what I would say. It came from me. You know, my parents were cool. They never really lost their temper. And I remember somebody asking me once, like, have you ever seen your dad cry? And I was like, I think I remember two very specific times when I saw my dad cry. But then I was thinking, man, I never in my life have ever seen my mother cry. Like, my mother never cried. And I was like, man, that's pretty powerful. She was always very emotionally intelligent. She kept her cool no matter what the situation was. And that, and, you know, you read books or you listen to podcasts or listen to things about people that also kept their cool. For example, Frank Abagnale, you know, Jr. He's known as the con man, the guy from Catch Me If You Can. Right. Yeah. So when I was in Russia early on, there was a tape cassette, if you remember that, you know. Somebody had left it, a previous missionary left it, and I picked it up, and it was Frank Abagnale giving a speech to the Air Force Academy. And he talked about his entire life, how he impersonated, you know, an airline pilot, a lawyer, a doctor, an investor. He did all these things, and I was just mesmerized. And when you're a missionary, you can't really listen to certain music or read certain books or do anything. So there's not a lot you can do, but this tape was allowed. And so every day at lunch, I would listen to this tape. It was like 45 minutes and I memorized this tape. And I was like, man, Frank is, you know, so amazing. Like, I want to be confident like him. I want to, you know, like, I want to be able to live a life that's full of adventure like him and everything else. And so just being cool, I learned from that experience, from that Frank Abagnale tape, you know, as well. And later in life,
you channeled that in that meeting.
I did, man. Later in life, you know, 5 years ago, I met Frank Abagnale and we gave a presentation together. And the guy was the coolest guy. You know, sometimes you meet your heroes or you meet celebrities and you're like, this guy's a total, you know, like, this guy, what a... Frank was so amazing. He was the nicest guy. We hung out. You know, he invited me to his house. It was just the coolest thing ever. And I guess that's how I'd answer that, man. It's just life experiences, cool, you know.
And like the right, it was the right tape at the right time. You know, you had it and then you put it into motion.
Hell yeah.
And you channeled that, you know, like, oh gosh, I've got to be this person, which I think is interesting, right? I think like a lot of people, you know, it's like, you know, it's putting into practice things that you learn. Obviously, yours is a little bit higher stakes than someone, you know, reading for, you know, a business or putting together planning. But, you know, it goes back to, I think, a lot of people that they listen to podcasts, they read books, but do they actually do anything about it? And, you know, you were kind of forced into it, but that's cool that it was kind of like right place, right time.
I tell people all the time, you know, they want to be thought leaders or they want to be a guru or a wellness coach. I'm like, don't be a thought leader, be an action leader. You know, don't be a guru, be a do-ru. You know, get up and do something. Take action, move, do something. Don't care what it is, just do something about it. And I love that mindset, that action-oriented mindset, you know. Because here's the deal, like a lot of times when I go speak or when we go train, you know, people, specifically like professional athletes will say, you know, Jason, I want you to motivate me, man. Just motivate me. And I say, I can't motivate you. I'm not even going to try. And they're kind of dumbfounded. They're like, well, what are you here to do then? And I say, the only person that can motivate you is yourself, because the only true motivation is self-motivation. I'm not going to be there 24/7. I can't wake you up in the morning. I'm not going to be your alarm clock. I can't hold your hand and walk you through all the things you need to do during the day. You need to do that yourself. Only thing I can do is I can inspire you. I can inspire you to motivate yourself so that you can take action, so that you can see results. And once you see results, you inspire yourself.
Yeah.
To get motivated, to take more action, to see more results. And so it's like this circle of inspiration, motivation, action, and results. And I just believe that. And it starts with doing something, taking one step, truth.
And how do you, where again, when you look back, and again, we'll jump into, you know, you kind of, you get back and then you go into Ranger school. But where did that come from? You know, again, like that ability, because I think a lot of times, you know, people take a different approach where it's, you know, they get into that position of authority or trust, and instead it becomes about advice, right? It becomes about, yeah, I'm going to give you this or that. You know, was this from your military experience? Was it from, again, like you talked about, like your, you know, like your upbringing, like where does that ability to be confident in that and confident in, you know, helping people work through it? Because I, you know, at least for me, I feel like a lot of leaders don't do that. A lot of leaders that, you know, they're really good at giving advice and having opinions versus, you know, helping people to pull it out of themselves. Like, do you, you know, when you think about, when you think back, like where does that seed come from?
I guess for my mother, you know, she said, show me your friends and I'll show you your future. You know, so I always tried to put myself around people that I wanted to emulate, that I wanted to be like.
How old was she? How old are you? Do you remember when she said that?
Oh, gosh. You know, probably going into my junior year, or I'm sorry, yeah, my junior high school stuff around that time.
Wow.
You know, because that's really when you start to develop and you start to, you know, decide who you want to hang out with, what you want to accomplish. Goals at one point maybe seemed insurmountable or are now feasible, you know? And so, you know, what it breaks down to is, you know, if you want the life of being a drug dealer, well, then hang around drug dealers and see what happens. You know, if you want a life of playing video games and doing nothing, then hang out with guys that are doing that. If you want to be on the varsity team, if you want to be a captain, hang around the varsity guys. You know, if you want to be a millionaire, hang around millionaires.
Yeah.
You know, they'll all rub off on you, and you'll realize as you hang out with these guys that they're not that different from you. They're not that more special than you are. You know, you can do the same thing. And when you're living in that unknown, you're fearful of doing something like that because you just don't know. And then once you're around people, they're doing something, you know it.
Yeah, you know, I can do that. I see what they're doing.
You see the template. Yeah.
Yeah. I love that advice, man. I think it's great. And I think it's interesting how, you know, again, from doing this podcast now for, you know, the last 4 or 5 months, real, you know, it's like, it's those weird moments that happen. And like you as a father, how old are your kids?
So I'm a young dad, even though I'm 44 years old, right? I got a 4-year-old daughter and a 2-year-old son.
Okay. All right. I'm 41 and have a 7 and a 3.
There you go. And so we're sort of in the same boat. Okay.
Yeah. 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 So I get it. It's, you know, it's interesting, you know, as a parent now to just think about, you know, that's something you took with you for life, right? And you're bringing it into your business now, and you took it through these various experiences, just the responsibility of what it actually means to be a parent, you know?
You know, when I think about being a parent, growing up, I really didn't know what fear is. You know, I won't say I was fearless, you know, but I would do stupid things, jump off tall things or, you know, go crazy because I didn't understand the consequences. And my mother used to tell me also, like, wait till you have your own kids and you'll see what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
You know, and now that I have my own kids, I'm like, I understand what fear is. You know what I mean? Like, when they do crazy things or when they're out and about, it's like, man, there's nothing more terrifying than them getting hurt or something happening. So you got to be
vigilant. Wait till they start school, man. Then it, you know, then that's when it becomes, you know, my son's only in first grade, but you start to see the, like, wait, some kid said what? It's like, but you can't control it, you know? And you can just, like, the things and the lessons we're talking about, you can arm them with this and, you know, hope that they make the right decisions.
Well said.
But it's, It's interesting, man. So, all right. So back to it. So go back to West Point, go into Ranger school. How did you choose that? You know, out of the different paths you could have, you know, done coming out of West Point, what was it about, you know, the Ranger school that really appealed to you? I mean, obviously too, and just for some context for people too, you know, did you make the decision? Was this before or after 9/11? Cause I know it's like right around that time.
It was definitely after 9/11. And so I graduated in June of 2001 and went to my officer basic course, OBC, in July. And 9/11 hit in September of that year, obviously, and it changed everything for us. You know, we were at one point, you know, an army that was training, that was getting evaluated based on your PT scores, your physical training scores, you know, and how you do on certain exercises to, yeah, all that's unimportant now. What's important is we're going to war and we got to train up to go to war. And so there was a completely different shift. And I thought to myself, if I'm going to do this, if I'm going to go to combat, you know, I'm going to be at the tip of the spear. You know, I want to be at the front. And so we went to pre-Ranger training, you know, at OBC. There's 100 guys that started, including my buddy, Andy, who convinced me to do it. You know, we played football together, and he's like, I'm doing it, man. And I was like, okay, if you're doing it, I got to do it. So that's my motivation. We'll do it together. It'll be fun, and we'll have the shared misery and everything else. And so the first day, you had to report at like 4 a.m. at this field. 100 guys were there, pre-Ranger training. I was there. Andy was not there.
What?
You know, what? So I was just like, where is this guy at? Like, what's going on? He didn't show up, and we just got our bags smoked, as we say in the military, for like 2 hours. You know, just crushed physically. And I, you know, we finished up. I went back to the barracks. We were living in like a kind of a hotel type area at the time. And I went to Andy's room and I banged on his door. He opened the door. He's in his boxers. You know, he's got sleep crusted in his eyes. And he's just like, oh, man, 4 a.m. came so early, bro. I couldn't get up, man. Sorry. And he kind of just shut the door. And I'm just like, are you kidding me, man? Like, I already went to the first day. There's no way I can quit now. I guess I showed up. Like, I can't not go. And so I finished up our pre-Ranger training. We finished with 13 guys pre-Ranger training out of the 100. So, you know, 87 guys quit along the way or got injured or whatever. Of the 13 guys that got selected to go to Ranger school, only 10 guys went to Ranger school. And of those 10 guys, I was one of only three that graduated.
Wow.
And so it was an amazing experience. It's very difficult. I'm proud of that experience. I had a blast at Ranger school. Not many people say that. I did. I thoroughly enjoyed my time there. Learned a lot. Became a man, you know, I guess you could say, in a way. Grew up a lot in the military, the ultimate military leadership course, Ranger school. And it was just awesome, man. You know, you instill this creed in your daily life and your mindset and internalize it. It's really cool.
Yeah. I mean, I've known some different folks and the experience I've heard is very similar that, it's just like that discipline is, I think it's like, it's almost impossible to unlearn. Like, you know, I'm sure many have, but it seems like it just sticks with you for forever.
Oh, no question. No question. There are many times when, you know, you're out even in training or in combat where it's cold, it's miserable, you know, life sucks. And you kind of look to your left sleeve where your Ranger tab is. And the joke in the military is if you're cold, just rub your Ranger tab for warmth, you know? and that's sort of a cool thing because it's like, it's reminding you that you went through hard things. You went through discomfort. You went through a tough situation, not just for a short period of time, but for months at a time. And you came out the other end successful, victorious. And so, you know, rubbing that tab or looking over that tab gave me a lot of confidence to continue when things were tough, as well as, you know, there's a 6-stanza Ranger creed, you know, that you memorize. And before you eat, you have to recite the entire creed verbatim without a mistake. And so doing that for months on end, you know, you really have that thing memorized for life. And so there have been many times when life has been tough and I've recited that Ranger Creed in my mind to remind myself, like, I can get through hard times. I can do hard things. And this is who I am. This is the type of person I am. You know, I'm never going to leave a man behind. I'm going to display the courage, the intentional courage required to fight on to the objective, you know, though I'd be the lone survivor. You know, like things like that. Like, no matter what, I'm going to get the job done. I'm never going to leave a guy behind. You know, that sort of thing is, it's really powerful. You know, the self-talk, you know, that you have.
Yeah. And so you finish Ranger school, you go to Korea for a little bit, right? And you serve like near the demilitarized zone, which has got to be pretty wild, or just again, like a completely, another completely different experience. And then you're deployed to Iraq, right? You were part of the, I guess one for 101st Airborne, right?
Yeah. 101st Airborne Division. I was in the initial invasion of Iraq. I joined the guys as we were coming up, and then we landed in Mosul, or outside of Mosul, in a little town called Arabia, which was on the Syrian border. And, we took over that town and we, basically established a base there. We did a lot of commerce and train the police and things like that. At the time, you know, the Iraq army kind of surrendered. They laid down their arms. They ran away. It wasn't much of a fight. And there weren't a whole lot of insurgent attacks, any terrorist attacks yet. I mean, we were driving around at that time with Humvees with the doors off. So it wasn't crazy yet, but you know, just wait a year and then it got crazy.
Yeah. What was that transition like, you know, as you, cause then I think like 2006, you start as a detachment commander. You know, what were those years like in between, you know, again, where you just, again, you were there in the very beginning to, you know, really seeing just a, you know, completely different scenario. It sounds like year over year, you know, what were some of the, you know, as you kind of think about that, and then again to where then you go into the detachment commander, where, you know, I think you led close to 300 missions, you know, across, you know, Iraqi and Kurdish lands and training soldiers, et cetera. So like, what were those first, you know, few years like? And again, because you can prep and be mentally there, but, you know, what are some things that stand out to you just from, you know, what changed over those first few years?
So after my first deployment, I went and tried out for the Special Forces. And over the next few years, I became a Green Beret and I got my team and we immediately deployed to Iraq for a rotation. And I was in the middle of Iraq, close to the Iranian border. And we were told to find a location, build a base, and take the fight to the enemy. That was basically it. It was the ultimate, you know, SF mission, you know, Special Forces mission. And my second day there, our convoy hit an IED and two of my guys got injured significantly and had to leave the country. So I knew we were in for a fight, you know, and it's a strange feeling knowing that whenever you leave the base, your compound, and you're driving down the street, there's a chance, you know, that you could hit a roadside bomb, you know, like, at any point, you know that like this could be the end for you. And it's an interesting feeling knowing that that's the case every time you leave the fence, you know, you get outside the wire. The location that we stayed at, it was getting mortared nearly every single night from a little town, a little village across this river. And we talked to the Iraqi army that we were stationed with, that we sort of embedded with, and they wanted nothing to do with that village. They were not going over there under any circumstances, even though the mortars, the direct fire was hitting their side of the base as well. They were just like, we're good. You know, they lost a couple guys, you know, from it. They're like, no, we don't want to mess with that. Baffling to me. We talked to the police and they're like, hell no, we're not going to go over there. And so I said, well, we need somebody to go over there. We need somebody brave. And it just so happened that the S2, the intelligence officer for the Iraqi army that we were sort of embedded with, he was Kurd. and he spoke perfect English, spoke, you know, Arabic and Kurdish and everything else. And he was like, Jason, the Iraqis aren't going to fight for you. The police aren't going to fight for you, but I know some people that will. And I said, well, tell me, who are they? And he said, my people, the Kurds, if you can somehow bring them down here, we will fight and we will fight to the death. And I was like, man, I like what I'm hearing, but I don't know much about the Kurds. I've never worked with them before. So I started to read a lot of books about the Kurds. I talked to General Petraeus, you know, through his channels about signing a waiver to allow the Kurds to come down past this demarcation line. And he agreed to it. And so next thing you know, I had 600 Kurds under my command and we trained them up and we went over to this village. And over there, there were 13 IEDs in the road. And the general of this Kurdish force, this Peshmerga force, and that's translated as to those who face death. And he got out of his vehicle and he picked up every single one of those IEDs and he dismantled it himself. And I was like, man, this guy is trying hard to impress me. And guess what? He's impressing the hell out of me. So we go into this village and the enemy, they see us coming. And so they leave. As was often their tactic, they see us coming, they leave, we leave, and they just come back in the village. But I employed a tactic that had never been really used before. Once we got to this village, I told this general, I said, hey, I want you and all your 600 guys to stay here. And don't go anywhere. And he said, yes, sir. And we left, and the enemy saw us leave, and they started matriculating back into the village, and the Kurds just caught them one by one. And next thing you know, like, this village is secured. And then we had a foothold and we just started taking the fight to the enemy. At my last battle there, I had managed to bring down 4,000 Kurds. And it was like the coolest experience you'll ever have. I was in charge of these 4,000 guys. I felt like Julius Caesar, you know, I'm standing in front of all these guys.
That's wild.
And they're all, you know, they got RPGs, they got AKs. They're in like all sorts of makeshift vehicles. There's like a Porsche 911. It's like rotted out, rusted out. The top roof of the 911 is cut out. There's a dude standing in his AK on the passenger seat. You know, there's all sorts of Toyota Hilux trucks. You know, I'm like, let's go. And like, it was just cool, man. And so we took down this entire town. It was, we liberated this entire town. It was taken over by, Al-Qaeda. You know, and my guys, it was like a two-day battle, man. It was insane, you know, and Kurds took the fight to the enemy. We completely liberated that city. It was a small city. I mean, it wasn't a village. There were buildings and the whole thing, and we took it over, man. And it was the best part of that, deployment, because we had four Purple Hearts on my 12-man team. My engineer, Sergeant Rob, he expired. He got shot in the head on a mission in August. My team sergeant got shot through both of his legs, and he survived. We got him back to the States. My warrant officer, he was injured. No, let me take that back. So my communications officer and my weapons sergeant, both of them were injured. And then a couple guys had to leave country for various reasons. So it was a rough deployment, and it was really hard to transition back to the States after that.
Yeah, and that's I mean, let's get into kind of what you're up to, what you've been up to. You know, before I do that, I want to ask a follow up. What did that moment, man? When I think about leadership, you know, and I think about the different ways, like, what did that moment, you know, you had 4,000 of these people that you've trained and are there, you know, again, and they're rusted out Porsches. Like, what did that teach you about leadership? And maybe you didn't realize it at the time, but, you know, or, you know, like, what was like, what are some things you look back and you're like, you know, these are some things I learned from that experience in particular around, you know, what it takes to lead and inspire.
One is you have to know what you're doing. Right. And I had a plan and I knew that plan backwards and forwards, and I knew what everyone was supposed to be doing in that plan. And I was confident in it. Right. And that confidence, would breed confidence, you know, just like calm breeds calm, man. Next thing is you got to find out what people's motivations are. And so I went to a bunch of Kurds with my translator, And I was trying to get them excited and fired up. Hey, we're going after these terrorists. You know, these terrorists are doing these, committing these atrocities in this city. This is what they're doing. And I was kind of met with blank stares by some of these Kurds. And I was like, you know, don't you guys want to, you know, go out there and administer justice and do the right thing? And they're like, we don't care about terrorists. And I was like, okay, what do you care about? And one of the guys said, are they Arabs? And I kind of looked at my translator. I'm like, yeah, they're Arabs. And I said, okay, we will kill the Arabs. I'm like,
oh my God.
Fair enough. All right, that's your motivation. You don't care about the terrorists. You just want to kill Arabs. All right, well, these terrorists are Arabs. So, you know, ipso facto, let's go get them. You know what I mean? And so that's one thing that you think about is what are their motivations? When you really start working with the leadership, you got to find out what their values are, what they believe in, what they're made of. You know, for me, I'll tell you that I'm all about determination, resourcefulness, and loyalty. So whenever I meet somebody who kind of embodies those values as well, like we become best friends. They get me and I get them. Like we're going to get the mission done no matter what. You know, you don't have to give me a whole lot of guidance and I'm not going to ask you a lot of questions. I'm going to figure a way to get it done. And I'm going to be loyal to you to the end, no matter what, no matter what. And if you're that way to me, then we can accomplish great things together. And I think, you know, probably the last thing is, as far as this mission goes and what you learned about leadership, you have to trust other people to do their job. You can't micromanage. You can't be everywhere at once.
Yeah.
You know, you have to say, all right, this is what I need you to do. I trust you. Go get it done. If you need any help, I'm here. Just communicate with me and let me know what's going on so I can pull levers for you so I can make sure you're getting what you need. And that's it. And if you can give other people what they need, they're going to give you what you need back. And so I'll leave you with those four lessons.
I love that, man. And I think what you said too, it's like, and it's what they need, not what you think they need. You know, and you know, as you talk about that story, you know, and understanding people's motivations, I think sometimes in leadership, you know, people have a sense for what they think someone should be doing or need. And sometimes, look, there's a line between teaching and coaching and mentoring and these things. But I think too often it's we're not focused enough on, again, giving them what they need versus what we think they need and versus what they think they need. And finding that balance. And so for you, you know, like, let's fast forward, you know, we're, you know, as we kind of like wrap up, and I feel like there's just so much you've done since then, but, you know, talk a little bit about Mission 6-0, you know, that transition, Warrior Rising. Obviously, everyone, make sure you go check out the book. I've got it right here, Deliberate Discomfort. I love the title too. And as you read the book, I think you'll kind of understand this mindset. And the interesting part is, you know, when I look at people who grew up in the professional world, that the mindset on a totally different scale is similar. And so, you know, talk about what you've been up to, what made you, you know, start again, Mission 6-0, and, you know, what you're excited about and, you know, what gets you excited as you look forward to.
Yeah, great question. I appreciate the plug. You know, go to Amazon.com to get the book, or you can go to DeliberateDiscomfort.com and pick up the book. It's number one Amazon bestseller. We're really proud of it. You know, I think you're getting a lot of value out of it, specifically with leadership. You know, it's all about getting comfortable being uncomfortable. And when I was getting ready to get out of the military, you know, I went on my last mission to Mali, Africa. And I came down with a seizure disorder somehow. Nobody really knows how or why, but I started having these epileptic seizures. And over the course of the next few years, they just never really went away. And so the military said, well, we need you to get out. And so I asked myself the same question all veterans ask themselves at some point. Now what? What am I going to do? And you remember me telling you earlier about what my mother told me when I was younger, show me your friends and I'll show you your future. A lot of my friends had gotten out of the military after 3 years, 5 years, and they'd started businesses and they were successful. Some of them had already exited, you know, at that point, and they'd made a lot of money. And so I thought to myself, if they can start a business, so can I. What would I start a business in? What do I know about? Well, I spent the last 20 plus years, West Point, leadership, you know, training, combat, leading soldiers, you know, tip of the spear, 1% of the 1% sort of thing. And I was like, well, I could add value because I'm an expert in those things. You know, I know more about that stuff than most people. Does anybody want this? And so I started cold calling NFL teams and one by one,
you know, I love it.
Cause I'm a fan of sports, man. And I finally alphabetically got to the New York Jets and they said, we'll give you a chance to present to us, but you're not going to get a contract or anything. It'll be a good experience for you. And so, I went up there to New York with two buddies of mine, a peer from West Point and a guy who was an NCO that kind of worked for me. And the three of us pitched to the New York Jets. And after the presentation was over, Rex Ryan, the head coach at the time, said, hey, congratulations, guys. You just landed your first ever contract and your first ever client is the New York Jets. And so we didn't even know what we were doing. You know, we didn't have like a curriculum or anything like that. We were just like, let's create it on the fly. And next thing you know, we've got this leadership development company. We're getting marketed on ESPN and the NFL Network. And it was just really cool, man. And so it's a leadership development company. We've got things have changed since COVID. We do a deliberate discomfort challenge. It's a 60-day challenge. It's for individuals or teams. You know, we have workshops. You know, we do still do team building events from time to time. We do keynotes. And then, you know, you could get the book or the audio book or anything like that. And so that's Mission 6-0. And then Warrior Rising, because of the success of Mission 6-0, I created a nonprofit to help other veterans find their purpose again through business ownership. And so if you're a veteran or an immediate family member of a veteran that wants to start a business or wants to accelerate a business, come to Warrior Rising and we'll help you do exactly that. You know, we're going to probably raise $2 million this year alone. We grow every single year. We're looking at helping 3,000 veterans this year start businesses. We're going to have probably 60 success stories this year. You know, business is tough and very rarely do you hit a home run right off the bat. So, 60 guys, we consider success stories, of our organization this year. Hopefully by the end of the year, we're pretty close to it. And then, we throw business showers 4 times a year in various locations where we give vets, you know, custom business suits, laptop computers, headshot photos, marketing videos, and opportunity to pitch so that they can get funding. And everybody that comes to our business shower gets money. The grand prize winner is a $20,000 winner, and then everybody else gets, you know, a lower number than that. So that's Warrior Rising. And if you want to learn more about
that, we'll link to all that in the show notes too. I mean, cool. I think for those of you, you know, again, if you're looking for, you know, the definition of leadership and individuals who can talk about leadership and under, you know, some of the most extreme and, you know, stress yet, you know, keep their cool and learn. And again, all the qualitative details. I mean, I can't think of a better group to, you know, to get to work with, you know, your company or you as an individual.
Thank you. Appreciate that a lot.
Yeah, it's a great, I really do. I really encourage everyone to check out the book. I mean, I think, again, even if you're not, even if you're on the front lines, and again, you talk about your experience with the Rangers and reciting and, you know, your own motivation, you know, and making sure that you're, you know, as humans, we, you know, we don't just rely on a company to sit there and motivate us, you know, to your point, right? It's not the company, you know, your company and your own professional development and growth, you know, they should helpfully support that, just like, you know, but you also have to have that mental fortitude and that mindset to grow yourself. Mm-hmm. So what's next, man? What's the next thing we can expect, you know, from you here, looking at 2022 right in the face here? You're doing so many amazing things. Like I said, everyone, please go check out the links. We'll put them in the show notes. What's next for you, man, as we wrap up?
Well, I appreciate it, brother. I'm trying, man. I'm trying. 2020.
I think you're doing more than trying, man. I think you're succeeding.
You know, here's the deal. The rest of the year, we're doing a few things. One, we're going to do a business shower in Palm Springs on November 11th on Veterans Day. And it's going to be an online kind of victory for veterans fundraiser. Rob O'Neill, the guy that shot Bin Laden, is going to be our guest speaker. And then December, our final business shower of the year is going to be in New York City to coincide with the Army Navy football game. So anybody in Palm Springs or in New York City that wants to attend that event, come to warriorrising.org or just email me at jason@warriorrising.org. Next year for Mission 6-0, you know, I'm hopefully going to finish my second book. You know, it's sort of a trilogy. So Deliberate Discomfort's the first book. I'm learning about leadership. Second book is about going to combat, and third book is going to be about returning from combat. And then kind of what did we learn? You know, where do we go from here? The Deliberate Discomfort Challenge is going to go hard again on January 3rd, Monday, January 3rd. So just in time for your New Year's resolutions, you want to get after it to start the new year, you know, go to the challenge.deliberatediscomfort.com. And we might have a couple new verticals next year. We're kind of working on that. Don't want to let anything out of the bag yet. So I'll let you know as that develops further.
I love it, man. I'm happy to promote it and, you know, make sure everyone gets over and checks it out. So look, Jason, I appreciate you, man. This is a great, I think, inspirational story that, you know, whether, no matter where you're at in your life, whether you're, you know, early in your career, maybe you're still in school, or you're, you know, early in your career, you're professional, you know, maybe, you know, you're trying to find what's right for you. I think some of these lessons about, you know, the control that you have on your, on how you approach situations and creating that discipline, you know, creating the discipline is the hard part. You know, once you get in the routine, you know, it's not that it's the easy part, but hopefully people can listen to this, go check out Warrior Rising and some of the other things you're up to and really start to set down that path, you know, for success. So again, Jason, really appreciate you, man.
Thanks, Jake. Appreciate you. Great show. Hopefully awesome. People are entertained.
Oh, I think so, man. I'm not worried about that. And I appreciate everyone. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Jake Dunlap Show. We will see you next week.
All right. Thank you so much, everyone, for tuning in to another extremely fun and interesting episode. I thought it was fun and interesting, so I hope you did too, of the Jake Dunlap Show. Really great just breaking down everything that makes people who they are, the success, the trials and errors, and I hope that you enjoyed it as much as I did. Make sure to subscribe on your favorite platform, and make sure more than anything to go over to jakedunlap.com. That's where you're going to stay up to date on all the latest guests, additional details, prep notes. We're going to be sharing everything on jakedunlap.com. So go ahead, go over there. You can subscribe there as well too. And we will see you next week on the Jake Dunlap Show.